Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest on this edition of the program is Sarah Margon, Washington Director at Human Rights Watch, an international non-governmental organization that conducts research and advocacy on human rights. Our topic, the political and humanitarian crisis in Iraq and Syria. In her capacity as director at the Washington Office of Human Rights Watch, Sarah Margon recently testified to the U.S. Congress about the reign of terror being inflicted by the so-called Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, also known as ISIL, IS or Daesh. She also denounces the atrocities committed by the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and expresses concern about the continued presence of Shiite militias in Iraq, who, for some Sunnis, are as menacing as Daesh. Before joining Human Rights Watch, Sarah Margon was Associate Director of Sustainable Security and Peacebuilding at the Center for American Progress. That's a liberal think tank here in Washington. There, she researched and wrote on a wide range of issues, including human rights, foreign aid, good governance, and global conflicts and crises. She also served as Senior Foreign Policy Advisor to former Senator Russ Feingold and as Staff Director to the Senate Foreign Relations Subcommittee on African Affairs. And Sarah Margon joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Well, Sarah, I want to refer to something you wrote in your testimony when you were testifying on Capitol Hill recently, talking about the terrible humanitarian situation in Iraq and Syria. And you talk about ISIS, ISIL, IS. You said the following. You said, ISIS didn't come from nowhere. In fact, they have been gaining strength for quite some time, taking advantage of the brutal crackdown by Syrian and Iraqi authorities, the marginalization of Sunnis that began over a decade ago after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and the conflict-related chaos in Syria, to name but a few. Similarly, the rapid territorial gains ISIS made this summer were largely enabled by the discontent that resulted from the Maliki-led government policies that fed a cycle of sectarian violence through exclusion and discrimination. And I read that because I wanted to provide a context for what we're looking at. So give us a sense of where we stand today. Has anything changed with respect to the situation?
I think if you look at the situation in Iraq, you have seen changes in the government. You now have a prime minister who has at least rhetorically committed to greater inclusion. He has taken some steps to do that. He has committed to getting rid of the 50,000 ghost, quote-unquote, ghost soldiers that he found in the military. He has supported General John Allen and the anti-ISIS coalition. He has committed to make sure that the military and the army stop shelling where civilians are. He has also begun a reconciliation process with Sunnis. I think from our perspective, however, these are really important first steps, but what they really need to do is get to the foundation of the institutional reform that has been missing for so long. And the security sector needs to be deeply, deeply reformed. And one of the issues is that the Shia militia are so integrated into the security forces. And Prime Minister Abadi has basically said, we will deal with the militias after we deal with ISIS. But the problem is you can't, that's not going to work. They need to be dealt with at the same time.
Indeed. And that leads me to the question, you know, are the political and security reforms to which you allude keeping pace with the so-called military strikes that the U.S. is leading on ISIS, ISIL?
So what we've seen is that there is definitely movement in Iraq on the political front. But I think one of the concerns that Human Rights Watch has had is that what we're seeing is still predominantly a military strategy. And the problem is you've got now more than 2 million people across Iraq displaced. You've got a Sunni population that is terrified not only of the government, but of these marauding Shia militias that act with complete impunity. This isn't setting the stage, if you will, for any kind of genuine political reconciliation. And down the line, there needs to be a balance of protection. It can't just come from military. It has to come from alternative non-military strategies. And we haven't seen that yet, and we don't have a full sense of what that is.
Well, to underscore what you said, I will also quote again from your testimony, and you say that you met a man in his late 40s, and we're still talking about Iraq for now, who was living in an abandoned strip mall, and he told you that, "I am no more afraid of Daesh," and of course that's the Arabic acronym for the Islamic State, "than I am of the Shia militias and the Iraqi government."
Yeah, that was a pretty incredible day. I was in Iraq in early October, and we had been trying to follow up on some information we had gotten about Shiite militias pillaging and destroying some of the Sunni villages south of Kirkuk. And so we went in and we spent some time with the Peshmerga and talked to them about what they had seen. And they were quite disgusted by the Shiite militias and were very upset with the abuses and the aggressiveness that they wanted to share that story. So we talked to them for a while. And then as we were going back to Erbil, we pulled over on the side of the road. I mean, there were displaced people everywhere. And so we pulled over on the side of the road to talk to basically an entire village that had been displaced. And they were living in this abandoned shopping mall. And this young guy came out and he sort of explained to us what had happened, why they had been displaced, the fact that they had gotten no assistance, and that they had been there for a few months, and that they were more terrified of the militias. And it really put in perspective the scariest and most abusive actor depends on who you are and what sect you come from.
Of course, you made reference to Peshmerga, and of course, this is the Kurdish militia.
Right.
And of course, they have been extremely effective, am I right, in terms of combating ISIS or ISIL?
The Peshmerga have been out on the front lines. And, you know, I think the effectiveness question kind of depends on who you ask. But yes, for the most part, they have been. You know, we are in the process of taking a look a little more closely at how the Pesh have been behaving and what they've been doing. But they've been the ones on the front lines, that's for sure. And they are the ones who are fighting and, for the most part, keeping a far better record than the Shiite militias.
So it looks like this remains a problem, these Shiite militias. And it sounds like, no matter what the new Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi wants to do, that he's running up against probably some hardliners in his Shiite coalition.
Yeah, I mean, look, I probably should have said this at the beginning as well. ISIS is an incredibly brutal group. They are just terrific. They don't hide their abuses and their atrocities. They post them on social media for everybody to see. They don't subscribe to the same norms and values that we do, and that's clear. So the international community is up against something else. But the context from which they've come is going to make the difference in how they're addressed. And so as not to further cement the growing polarization in Iraq, Prime Minister Abadi has to think about how his government is functioning. And the fact in this case that he has an interior minister who is closely aligned with some of the worst Shiite militias, including the Badr Brigade, is a problem. It doesn't set the right tone. And the fact that the United States government hasn't come out and said anything about that also runs the risk of having the U.S. be seen as aligning itself with one sect over the other.
Well, that leads me to ask you about the United States' role. You say they haven't spoken out. Why? Do you see perhaps a change in the offing as they recognize what Human Rights Watch is saying about the fact that military strikes alone are simply not enough, that we need to push forward these political reforms so that the Sunni population in Iraq and in Syria see that they're a part of the governing structure and not marginalized and therefore likely to side with the likes of Daesh, the ISIS, which is, as you say, horrific?
You know, I think what was so amazing in the advent of this most recent crisis was President Obama's comments about the need for the government of Baghdad to change. It was coming from the top, the need for inclusiveness and the need for change and the reluctance, sort of an unwillingness to go in fully and embrace the current government because of their behavior. And that was incredibly impressive to hear those comments. We haven't heard quite as much since Prime Minister Abadi has taken over. And there have been some good changes in government. But again, it's clear that the government of Baghdad wants and needs the U.S. support. They need them as a partner. And so from my perspective, that's incredible leverage for the United States to say, look, we're not just going to support you in a military campaign, which Human Rights Watch takes no position on, but we also want to see a more inclusive government from the top to the bottom, which requires deep institutional reform. It's not easy. My understanding is General John Allen has been tasked with security sector reform of the Iraqi security services. The U.S. has already done that and spent well over $1 billion doing that. It's going to be tough. There's a lot going on there. But if the U.S. is committed to helping the Iraqis get it right this time, they need to be out and talking much more about in Iraq for all Iraqis, ensuring that the integration in the military really happens this time, that command and control is clearly aligned with what the Constitution says, those types of steps. And some of them, of course, have to be private and done behind closed diplomatic doors, but others can be public. And it's important not just to talk to the government in Baghdad, but to the people throughout the entire country.
In your context with the government and perhaps civil society in Iraq, do you sense a recognition that only a deep-rooted political solution is going to solve this problem of ISIL, ISIS, that unless and until the Sunni population, which is a minority, right, in Iraq, but unless they feel more included, a part of the governing structures, the economic situation, that they will be on the fence at best and perhaps at worst side with ISIS or ISIL?
I mean, negotiating with the leaders of ISIS, I think, is probably off the table. They're not interested in political negotiations. They've made that clear. But I think part of what has to happen is that the Iraqi government needs to make clear and show the steps that they're willing to take to include all Sunnis, all Yazidis, all Iraqis in their government. And there are certainly opportunists who are beginning to join ISIS, or if they're not joining, at least fight alongside them. And it is those types of steps, creating opportunity for freedom of expression, creating political engagement, enfranchising basically the entire Iraqi population and not preying on them because they are of a different sect. Those types of steps are hugely important. There are virtually no wars that are won through solely a military solution. In fact, none. It is always essential to have a political solution.
Before we go to a break, what about the role of Iran? Now, we know the Iranians are huge backers of the current Iraqi government, have been since Maliki, and of course, were actually quite instrumental in his ouster and now backing Haider al-Abadi. Do they play a positive role in your view, or are they part of the problem with respect to supporting some of these Shiite militias?
They're certainly supporting Shiite militias, and I think part of the problem is the deeply regional nature, if you will, of the crisis and the conflict that's going on. For a long time, Human Rights Watch has been calling on the United States to be very cautious, adhere to the Leahy Law when they provide military equipment. Leahy Law being the human rights vetting requirement for all foreign governments that receive U.S. military or security assistance. And one of the concerns that I've heard time and time again is that, well, if we don't get in there and provide this assistance and training, the Iranians are. And from my perspective and from what I saw and heard when I was there, the Iranians are already playing a very relevant role. So it's not a sufficient justification for the U.S. to waive the Leahy Law and stop doing human rights vetting or continue providing big-ticket defense items that the Iraqis want without making sure that they're going to stay in the hands of the people that they send them to. So, you know, I think Iran's there. This is no secret to anybody, but it shouldn't be necessarily how and why the U.S. makes its policy. U.S. should be making its policy for smart reasons.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Sarah Margon, Washington Director at Human Rights Watch and former Associate Director of Sustainable Security and Peacebuilding at the Center for American Progress. I'm Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. You can also send feedback via email to PCUSA@voanews.com. Either way, tell us where you're from and how you listen to the program. Here's a shout out to a new listener, Sam Khan from Phnom Penh, Cambodia. Well, back to you, Sarah Margon. Let's turn now to Syria, because obviously ISIL knows no boundaries. They are intent on establishing what they call a caliphate that spans Syria and Iraq. And we know, too, that the civil war in Syria has been exacerbated by their presence and expansion. But we also know that the brutal tactics used by Syrian President Bashar al-Assad have actually helped to fuel the rise of ISIL. Where do we stand in Syria?
Syria is in many ways the missing piece of the puzzle here. We don't hear very much about Syria anymore. It's not talked about. It doesn't seem to be a core part of U.S. or policy or even the international coalition against ISIS. And yet, the crisis is at unprecedented levels. You have 11 million refugees. You have a government that is so brutal and continuing to be so, and basically seems to be benefiting from the fact that everybody is so focused on ISIS. When you talk to Syrians that have fled or Skype with them, as a lot of my colleagues who do research do, one of the things that we continually see is that the government of Syria continues to be the most brutal and continues to be the one attacking the most civilians. So when civilians express their fear, it's really predominantly coming from the government of Syria. The government of Syria is still using barrel bombs, conventional weapons, to go specifically and explicitly after civilians. That needs to be part of the conversation, because without addressing that conflict there, you're just going to see ISIS and a whole number of other really nasty armed groups continue to do what they're doing.
And I've heard some analysts say that U.S. airstrikes in Syria targeting ISIS, ISIL, have actually emboldened or actually benefited the Syrian government of President Bashar al-Assad, the one you say, you know, is still using barrel bombs and targeting his own people by going after ISIS. We have given Bashar al-Assad free rein to then attack the so-called moderates, what is left of them in the Aleppo area. I mean, what about this does the United States not understand? I mean, we hear about the United States saying that they're going to try to ramp up, vet and train moderate Syrian rebels in both Saudi Arabia and Turkey. But where is that going? And is it going to be fast enough to both root out both ISIS and marginalize or weaken Bashar al-Assad?
Yeah, I mean, Human Rights Watch, we take no position on the training and support for the Syrian opposition. But I think what we're seeing is that amidst all these big geopolitical concerns, the civilians in Syria have basically been forgotten and neglected. And from our perspective, they're actually at the center of all of this, because it is a strategy of cruelty that President Assad is using. He is purposefully not allowing humanitarian aid in so civilians suffer. He is taking steps to inflict greater harm on civilians, whether they fled the country or are still displaced within them. And what we see is that this crisis is going to go on for a long time. There's no near-term solution. So even if the U.S. does actually get up and running with an opposition force, given the current dynamics on the ground and the strength of so many of the other armed groups, I'd be hard-pressed to understand how they're actually going to be able to do what the U.S. expects them to do. But then how do they handle the protection problem of civilians? Because as I understand it, that's not necessarily part of their mandate. And this, to me, is a huge issue, because if the U.S. isn't able to gain the support of the Syrian people, the U.S. is going to end up doing itself damage more down the line. And that, to me, that's a huge part of this that nobody's talking about. And the abuses are ungodly, and the deprivation of food. And with the winter there yet again, I mean, the numbers and the percents of children that are suffering in the Syrian conflict is just, it's ghastly.
I know. And also the camps in Jordan and Turkey, I assume that the conditions are also very precarious.
The conditions are tough. I think in many cases, the host governments, particularly Jordan and Turkey and Lebanon, are doing what they can. Mm-hmm. But there just isn't enough capacity or enough resources. I mean, this is the world's greatest crisis. There are not enough resources to go around. And even in Lebanon, which is hosting such a significant portion of the Syrian refugees, they didn't have the resources and capacity to manage it when it was a far fewer number, not to mention the political dynamics that are shifted with the onslaught of so many Syrian refugees, most of whom in Lebanon are living in camps.
Well, just as in Iraq, there is no military solution. Deep-rooted political changes need to occur, and that's the same for Syria. And now we're reading that the European Union is talking about a so-called new approach to Syria. They want to try again to engage with Russia and Iran, both of whom back President Bashar al-Assad. What are the prospects for reaching some kind of a political solution that would be agreeable to all parties and put an end to this horrific conflict?
I think it's going to be a long slog. I mean, this was tried last summer to no great effect. And I think until Russia and Iran and some of the other backers feel the consequences of supporting President Assad, there isn't going to be a lot of change. The U.S. and the EU have some of the tools they need to pressure these other countries. You know, if you look at the U.N. Security Council's resolution on cross-border humanitarian aid, I think it's Resolution 2165, it's an indication of intent. And that was passed. There were no vetoes on that resolution, but there have been no consequences for Syria's failure to uphold it. That requires the allowance of cross-border and cross-line aid. It requires all parties to stop attacking civilians. It requires the government to stop using barrel bombs. That was authorized by the UN Security Council not all that long ago, and yet it's been pretty clear that a lot of it has been violated, and to what end? And so I think if they're going to look at political negotiations, they need to think about the consequences of what happens when failure to uphold any commitments are made.
So what are your recommendations vis-a-vis the situation in Syria? What would it take for these countries, Iran and Russia, who are backing this brutal dictator, who in fact is fomenting the rise of ISIS, which in and of itself obviously is extremely heinous, but theoretically, or one could argue that it would not have gained so much ground had Bashar al-Assad not had the backing of these major powers, their military backing, the backing of Shiite militias, Hezbollah, and perhaps even other militias directly from Iran.
The United States and to some large extent the EU were pretty quick to respond to Russia's territorial grabs in Ukraine and Crimea with sanctions that went a pretty far distance. And they've been much slower to hammer out hard-biting sanctions on Russia for their actions in Syria. Russia continues to provide defense equipment to the Syrian government. There are a number of companies and banks that could be sanctioned. And that's one place to start in looking at the consequences for action. I think the other option is going back to the UN Security Council and taking a look at what's been violated when it comes to the most recent Security Council resolutions and how to hold them accountable for their violations.
But also it seems to me that the perception on the part of perhaps the U.S. government, maybe other governments around the world, is that they look at the symptom of the problem, and that is the growth of ISIS, as opposed to the cause, which is, of course, the government of Bashar al-Assad and his backers, Iran and Russia. And it seems to me that's the dilemma. They want to strike ISIL and say, you know, these are bad guys and they might come and try to harm us, you know, the beheadings and the foreign fighters that are joining ISIS. And they look at that as opposed to, you know, looking at a much more holistic strategy. And then, of course, there are those negotiations with Iran, the nuclear negotiations that the P5 plus one doesn't want to seem to disturb, that takes a priority over dealing with Iran vis-a-vis its nefarious activities in Syria.
I mean, there's a lot of geopolitical issues to look at when you're dealing with the Middle East right now, and it's even outside of Iraq and Syria. But, you know, from our perspective at Human Rights Watch, civilians shouldn't be stuck in the middle of a conflict. They shouldn't be directly attacked by government. Those issues can be addressed outside of solving the wider geopolitical framework, which is also going to take time. But they've been abandoned. You know, today the UN announced about $15 million for Iraqi IDPs in the Anbar region and outside of Kirkuk. This is huge because the north and central regions of Iraq have been just as lacking in receiving humanitarian assistance. So this is a really important first step. But getting at those populations that are forgotten or besieged, it should be a priority for the UN, for the international community, providing them with support, both humanitarian basic service needs, but also with the protection that they need. That needs to be a central priority of all U.S. policy because it's a longer-term approach. What you're talking about and what we're looking at is a short-term approach that isn't going to bear fruit and actually get at the heart of what we're dealing with.
Indeed. I have a couple of questions about ISIS, ISIL, whatever you want to call it, Daesh. What are you hearing about how they are recruiting both among local populations and in regards to foreigners?
Well, you know, our research on ISIS has really been looking at how they act on the quote-unquote battlefield, if you will. And so, you know, our main concern is basically how they entice and engage with people living under ISIS and keeping – they're brutal. And they do it often with force, but they are very well funded. They present opportunities for foreigners abroad.
They're funded primarily through their own revenue-generating activities,
that's right?
That's right.
It's quite remarkable. I mean, we understand they make something of about $2 million a day. We haven't done the research on that, but many other well-respected analysts have. And it's quite incredible to see how well-funded they are, which makes it a lot harder to get at them, I would think, and cut them off at the knees, so to speak, because they are funding their own initiatives.
What about the role of Saudi Arabia and some of these other Gulf states? Do you see, you know, whether before or even currently, are they, because of their still negative feelings vis-a-vis Iran and the fact that Iran is supporting Bashar al-Assad and Iran is backing Haider al-Abadi in Iraq, have they really come to terms with both these countries, or are they sort of still secretly sort of supporting, ideologically at least, ISIS because they are, you know, against these governments. I'm just wondering.
Yeah,
about
I mean, we haven't looked into it. I mean, what the Saudi government does, and then there's what individuals within Saudi do.
Officially, I think, they would not, certainly not support them.
So there's that juxtaposition. I mean, I think Saudi has played a very important role in joining the coalition and making clear that ISIS is unacceptable. But there are a host of geopolitical issues, like I mentioned before, that just need to be addressed. And I think within that larger framework, our piece is looking at the civilians and the abuses that have occurred and trying to get all actors to stand up and uphold international human rights and humanitarian law, which is particularly difficult when you have a group like ISIS that doesn't care about it and doesn't subscribe to the same conventions that the rest of the world does. It presents particular challenges for trying to address the violations that are going on.
And as we conclude, Sarah Margon, how would you summarize your recommendations to the Congress with regard to these crises in Iraq and Syria? What are you looking for Congress and the Obama administration to do going forward?
From the administration, I'd like to see some clearer guidance on what the non-military strategy is and how protection can be part of that. A military operation is not protection for everybody. It's two different things. Nobody's saying they don't have national security concerns here, but protection for Iraqi civilians needs to be part of a wider plan. Congress has an important role to play in asking questions and performing oversight in making sure that any money that goes to the Iraqis in particular is done in a way that doesn't violate U.S. law and is robustly vetted to make sure that U.S. taxpayer dollars are not used inappropriately. I was pleased to see the two hearings last week in both the Senate and the House because I thought it was a sign of this wider thinking. There's a long road to hoe. That's clear. And we're going to need smart U.S. engagement.
Sarah Margon is Washington Director at Human Rights Watch. Sarah, I can't thank you enough for coming in, sharing your terrific insights.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Glenn Von Calio. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to pcusa@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.